Boy, a lot of people are very sure about which direction the United States is going. America is in decline, or we're finally making America great again. I avoid both of those people at parties, and I look around for someone like Sarah Vowell. In the decades since she was a This American Life contributor, she's been writing books about American history, and she often reminds us that this country's always been troubled. So I asked her, which way are we headed?
That's the Seattle welcome to ask the subject whether the country is going down the tubes or not. That's your icebreaker.
Exactly. And then we get to the harder stuff later on, but this is just the opener, you know?
Uh-huh.
So yeah. what does 2018 America look like to an ironic historical raconteur?
I mean, the great thing about being a writer who writes a lot about history is, on any given day, if the present is too mopey or horrifying or just debilitating, you can always time travel back to the past, you know? And so I can spend 4 hours in the Lincoln administration if I want. I don't know what the rest of you do, and you have to live in the present all day, every day.
Well, it just seems like you're always thinking about how America's been a jungle for a long time. You never had the idea that things were better back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this Make America Great Again is such a comical phrase. I mean, especially for those of us who aren't white males. Yeah, I mean, there isn't literally no good old days. It's interesting. The founding, you know, when the Continental Congress got together in 1774, well, the first thing that happened is someone made a motion that they should open with a prayer. And the second thing that happened was a couple of Episcopalians stood up and basically said, I'm paraphrasing here, but we don't want to pray with all these other kooks, these Congregationalists and Quakers. And Sam Adams stood up and said he wasn't a bigot and he could hear a prayer from any gentleman of piety and virtue. But right in the first 5 minutes, the country could have fallen apart. And maybe that would have been the way to go. It could have spared us all a lot of grief and, you know, the Civil War and whatever we're going through right now. I mean, even in the first couple of months of the country becoming a country, when it was just a bunch of white male Protestants in a room in Philadelphia, the country was already too diverse. It was already too physically spread out. You know, how can Quakers and Congregationalists become a country? How can people from Massachusetts and Virginia share a country? I mean, we're still dealing with these questions.
I'm in the state of Washington next to the University of Washington, where there's a big old statue of George on the campus. If you could take that statue down, would you do that?
Why would I do that? Oh, because Washington owned slaves? I mean, I go to a lot of universities doing a lot of readings and lectures, and there is, a movement afoot. I mean, I had a student at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, last fall. I was giving a lecture there, and I was talking about Washington's commitment to the Bill of Rights, and specifically the letter he wrote to the Jews of the synagogue in Newport about the Bill of Rights. And it's this very beautiful, very historical letter where he says, you know, because of the First Amendment, we're all equal. He says tolerance is no longer necessary because tolerance means one group deigns to put up with everyone else. And it's kind of a big civil rights landmark, this letter, because it's the first time a president, the first president, tells non-Christians, you are my equals. And a student at MIT, when I was talking about this, started crying, like weeping audibly. And I had to stop the lecture and ask her what was wrong. Because, you know, sometimes you do a lot of public events, there's a seizure or some kind of medical situation.
Mm-hmm.
But she was weeping because she found it too painful to hear someone speak well of a slave owner. You know, we don't get to pick our founders, but there's no United States without Washington. So I guess if you don't want there to be a United States, maybe it would be easier to tear his statues down. But I mean, I'm not explaining away his slave ownership. That is a black mark on his record and his soul. And, you know, the fact that our country was founded by so many people who owned other people is, that is the gist of the country. I don't know. I mean, I understand the misgivings about Washington, but that's different, I think, than taking down a statue of, say, Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was a traitor, you know, committed to bringing down the United States of America and taking up arms against the United States of America to perpetuate the institution of slavery. Like, that is different. And, like, yeah, let's rip all those down. I don't have a problem with that.
What if we took down all the statues for of people, you know, instead of literally putting these complicated human beings on a pedestal? What if we took them? What if we took them down for like 50 years?
That would be a pretty ugly day in America. Like, I mean, it would be great for the bulldozer operators, I'm sure. But,
yeah,
you know, I mean, here in my, I'm talking to you from my hometown in Montana. I mean, one of my favorite statues is of Jeanette Rankin, who was the first female member of Congress, you know, and she was a Montanan. She was in Congress before most women, especially east of the Mississippi, had the right to vote. Like, she got to vote on women getting the vote. And we have a statue of her across from the post office that is just so kind of funny looking and charming. And every time I vote, I go and stick my I voted sticker on her little boot. You know, she's like a friend of mine. So I don't want you tearing that down. There's another statue. It's actually made by the same man. His name is Jim Dolan. He does a lot of the statues around here, mostly of bears and geese and stuff like that. But there's a statue of one of the founders of the town, his grandson, who was really old when I was a kid. His name was Malcolm Story, and he was just this old guy shuffling around town in a plaid coat. And there's a statue of him in front of my old middle school of his plaid coat, and it's just like this guy we all grew up saying hi to on the street. That just reminds me of being a kid in Montana every time I walk by that statue, you know. So they're not all fraught.
Well, what if we took them all down? That's good for Big Bulldozer, and then we stored them all, and that's great for big storage, and then, let's say in 50 years, then we decided, okay, now we have websites, we have interactive, there's lots of, where no one's gonna not know about George Washington, but let's decide Washington or this guy in Montana, we'll decide who we want to put back up, and we'll also make those union jobs too.
Oh, this is such a public radio conversation.
I didn't say permanent.
Like, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I actually, as someone, I write about history, but I also write about how history is remembered, which means I have written a lot about statues and things of that nature. And, you know, sometimes there's a lot you can learn from those statues. I remember there's one in, there are a few statues in New York City in Madison Square Park. There's one of Chester Arthur, and it says he was the president, because a lot of people don't remember him being president. He wasn't president for long. Mm-hmm. And then there's a statue of Roscoe Conklin, I think was his name, and he was a senator, and then he was basically like the political boss of New York for a long time, at least a couple of decades, I think. And he was probably one of the five most powerful men in America at one point in the 19th century. And it just says his name because, of course, everyone's always going to remember who Roscoe Conklin was, you know. But I mean, I used to live around the corner from that statue, and basically all it is, no one remembers who he is. And all it is just a thing for dogs to pee on, you mm-hmm. know. But it says something about the fact that this one guy was president and he has to be identified as such. But this other guy was so powerful, they just assumed everyone in perpetuity would remember who he was and how powerful he was. And, you know, no, he's just kind of, he's in the dustbin of history, but his statue lingers on because, you know, bronze is a very sturdy material.
Yes, it is.
But I think there are just things to be learned, you know, things to be learned about history from stuff like that. I remember also in New York City, my favorite plaque was, there was a plaque for, it was marking the spot where Peter Stuyvesant, the governor of New Amsterdam, where his pear tree had been. And Peter Stuyvesant had planted this tree in the 17th century. And around the time of the Civil War, there was a carriage accident. It was destroyed by the carriage wreck. And they put up a plaque because, you know, the old Dutch governor's tree was this, like, famous landmark. And we have to remember where that tree was, you know. And so sometimes you can find out what past generations found important.
It's a landmark to remember this dead guy's landmark.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, it's also, you know, a city, if you know, or a town, or anywhere in between, is this kind of almost like sedimentary rock where there's just this pileup of stories. And sometimes these statues or these plaques or whatever, no matter how boring or insignificant they seem, it just, if you're hip to them and who the people were, it makes you feel like part of the human continuum. So it makes it feel like, you know, getting your dry cleaning is a much more storied errand.
Right. Everything it took to get us to this dry cleaning bag.
Mm-hmm.
You're somebody who knows a lot about American founders, and I often hear people say the founding fathers predicted the Donald Trumps. They put up safeguards against tyrants. And I'm not sure, I mean, the Electoral College was not a bulwark, and our president can fire the FBI director and the special counsel and can possibly pardon himself. So do you think it's our founders' system that looks over us, or is it just human beings? What do you think about that whole question?
It's hard to say. I mean, obviously, they weren't perfect. There were some errors made at Independence Hall. I mean, I would look to, there's a speech that I love that Abraham Lincoln gave at the Lyceum in Springfield when I think he was 28 years old. It's generally you can find it, the speech to the Young Men's Lyceum. And he, it's basically, it's the speech where he says that the Constitution should be read by mothers to the babies on their knees, and it should become the political religion of the country. And one reason he's giving this speech is there's a lot of mob rule vigilante activity, and there was this abolitionist newspaper editor who was murdered in Illinois, and his printing presses were thrown into the Mississippi. And, you know, Lincoln has a real problem with this. And in that speech, he says, America will never be conquered by foreigners. It'll never be conquered by a Bonaparte. A foreigner is never going to take a drink from the Ohio in conquest. And if this country dies, it dies by suicide. And to him, the only way to keep that from happening is for each generation to renew their devotion to the Constitution in the same way that the revolutionary generation were devoted to the Declaration of Independence, that this constant renewal and vigilance is what is required to keep the republic, which, you know, is also what Franklin said, you've got a republic if you can keep it. And so I think they were aware it wasn't going to be easy. And certainly, you know, a lot of Lincoln's writing, especially leading up to the war, there is that question, does this country persevere? Does it continue? And that was always a question. I think, you know, it's been more than 200 years and we take that a little more for granted. But I mean, I would say the bright side of the dispiriting state of public discourse of late is a lot of people are not taking it for granted anymore. They're not taking the Constitution for granted. I mean, I was doing a talk in North Carolina last fall where this town of Durham decided to read the Constitution together. And when I was leaving the airport, at the airport bookstore, there was a stack of constitutions. And I asked, and this was the Raleigh airport, are you selling those because of Durham? And the lady said, no, we've been selling those every day since the president's inaugural speech. They've been selling 5 or 6 copies of the Constitution a day, every day. So, I mean, I found that pretty encouraging. Why am I being so on the bright side? It's because you're Yeah, I think it is weird. I'm supposed to be the pessimist, but you seem so pessimistic. I don't know why I'm trying to cheer you up.
Well, thanks.
Like, that's my job.
Sarah Vowler, looking forward to seeing you in Seattle. Thanks for this chat.
My pleasure, and cheer up.
Yeah, you're helping.
Thank you.